The CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phones, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Are you ready, Steve?
Uh-huh.
Andy?
Yeah!
Bert? Well, all right, fellas. Well, let's go!
You're listening to CFRN, the Christian Financial Radio Network.
Today's broadcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/CFRN. Over 85,000 titles. Choose from mystery, romance, religion, science, technology, business, New York Times bestsellers, even children's books. You name it, Audible has it. With 85,000 titles to choose from, you're sure to find the perfect audiobook for yourself or to give as a gift, and it's absolutely free. Just point your browser to audibletrial.com/CFRN. That's audibletrial.com/CFRN. And become a part of the audiobook revolution by downloading your free audiobook today. audibletrial.com/CFRN.
Hey, trader, want to get rich quick? Well, good luck with that. If, on the other hand, you actually want to learn how to trade, the place to be is www.cfrn.net. Tune in Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern, for our daily devotional, and then spend the next 3 hours learning how it's done from professional traders who actually trade for a living. That's www.cfrn.net. Every trading day from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern, CFRN, a community of believers who trade for a living.
Good afternoon, traders, and welcome back to the CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast. This is the daily broadcast of indeterminate length where we discuss all things E-Mini along with some really big ideas on the finer points of trading gold, bonds, crude, sugar, the euro, and even T-bills. Joining us today from our studios in Boston, Mr. Michael Bork. From our trading desk in Chicago, Mr. Burton Schlichter. And from our studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, Mr. David Williams. Now, to get things started, let's go to our host and founder in Studio A, overlooking South Mountain, America's largest city park. Here's Dwayne.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. Today is Monday, 19th day of February, 2013. Quick look at the numbers. The Dow up 55, S&P up 8, comp up 12, gold down 7 bucks, crude down a nickel. We got some headlines. Google, Hotmail, Best Buy, food stamps, Danica Patrick, Third Point. But we're going to save those because Michael has got some things he has to take care of. And so we're going to jump right in and do the recap. Now, for those of you that are visiting us for the very first time, welcome. Glad to have you with us. Here's how things roll on a typical day. We open the show. I go over a few headlines. We look at a couple charts. And then Michael does a recap of everything that happened in the live trading room. Yes, we have a live trading room where we trade live every day for 2 hours from the market open at 9:30 a.m. Eastern until 11:30 a.m. Eastern. If you would like to join us in the live trading room tomorrow morning, simply go to cfrn.net/apply. No credit card required. Love to have you join us. Once Michael completes the recap, we then go out to Las Vegas, Nevada, talk to our friends David Williams at PageTrader.com and Miss Robin Dane, the trading coach, on days that she is here. Today happens to be one of the days when she is not here. So once Michael finishes the recap, I'll just cover a couple of really quick headlines, nothing major, and then we'll scoot right on out to Vegas, talk to David, and we'll see what we can figure out. Oh, the market, I don't know. The chart, if you're looking at my charts, this is an hourly chart of the S&P 500 E-mini futures. This is yesterday, holiday, President's Day. We wouldn't expect anything more than that unless we had been around on previous holidays where we know that the market can actually travel a fair distance on a small amount of volume. Yesterday was not such a holiday. The swing high on the Globex session was 1519. The swing low on the Globex session and the day session, 1516. So we had a 3-point range there for basically 24 hours. Three. Even when the S&P is asleep, it usually moves more than 3 points, but not yesterday. Midnight came along, the holiday is officially over, London opens, and we catch a bit of a rally up to 1522.23. We move through that pretty briskly, and then we hover on the top for 2 hours. And now, what have we done? Well, I'll show you. We just hit our next weekly trading zone. We are a little bit shy. We're 1 point shy. It's 1527.28. So, yeah. 22, 23. There we go. So we've actually covered two zones today. Relatively quiet trading from 16 down at the swing low on Globex to the most recent swing high up at 26. That's 10 points, right? It's not so bad. Volume-wise, I bet it's a different story. Let's go take a look at that. So far today, 806,000. Well, again, not so bad. I mean, it's rare the day that we start the radio show that we've got more than a million traded in the S&P of late. Anyway, enough of that. Let's let Michael do the recap so he can take care of what he needs to take care of, and then we'll figure out something to say about these markets here. Michael, good afternoon. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dwayne. All right, let me grab the charts. Okay.
For those of you visiting for the first time who don't know, if you have questions, type them into the chat box. We'll be happy to answer them. If it's about a market we're discussing, that's okay. If it's about a market we're not discussing, that's okay. If it has nothing to do with the markets, you can type that in too. Chances are we'll probably answer it.
Give me just a second here, Dwayne. Okay, you guys should be looking at my charts, right?
I'm looking at your charts.
Dwayne?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm looking at your charts. All right, and also for anyone visiting for the first time, if you can only hear the sound of my voice and you don't see the charts, just go to our homepage, cfrn.net. On the right-hand side, you'll see a red, white, and blue button that says click here. If you do that, follow the instructions, you'll be able to see the charts as well as hear my voice. Now, it's nice to be able to see the charts so you can see what we're talking about, but that also puts you in the room so that you're able to ask questions, type into the chat box, and actually participate in the discussion, be a part of what's going on. You may have also noticed when you registered today to come into the radio program that your registration is good until the end of March. The next 29 radio shows. If you register today, you're good to go for the next 28 days. Okay, 28, 29, until the end of March. Yeah. We used to do it every week, and then we went out on a limb and went 2 weeks, and So now we've gone way out there. And just trying to make it more convenient for you, the listener at home, or at work, or wherever you might be. Are you with us?
I am.
Are you ready?
I am back. Sorry about that. Yeah.
You ready to go?
Yeah. I am ready to go.
Okay.
Let me minimize a couple of things here. All right. All right. I have to do the recording. Here we go. Ready? And all right. Good afternoon, everyone. Today is Tuesday, February 19th, 2013. This is the day after President's Day holiday. And it was sort of holiday trading today, it seemed like. There was some movement this morning. Soybeans just took off after we closed the morning session. Our results for the morning trading, we got our 2 points. It took us 77 minutes today to get our 2 points. We had 3 break-even trades prior to getting our 2 points, and we finally got our 2 points. I'll show you a few things here as we go through the charts. I'll show you a few things. We started off with a break-even trade on crude oil, but we're trading the H contract this morning when we started off on crude, and we took a break-even on that trade, and then we moved over to the J contract, okay? And we took a couple more trades on that. We took another break-even trade right here, and this was the trade where we took our 2 points. All right, so let's just go through this. All right, when the market opened up, there were trades in here that we missed. All right, I was doing stuff this morning. Doing stuff, we'll call it that. But we missed a few trades in here right at the morning, right at the open. And we took a short trade over here. Now, what we were looking for here is we had a bearish cross. Price pulled away from the BBC, came back up and tested the BBC. When it tested it, the cycle was blue. All right. So in that case, you need to draw a trend line and wait until you get a close down below the trend line. We got the close below the trend line, and then the next bar closed down below the MA1. That's when I moved my stop to break even. All right. I had my stop at break even. It came back out. I mean, it came back up, took me out of break even, and then it changed directions. I got long over here once it changed directions. Now, this was a little different kind of trade, all right, because the cycle was blue. I didn't have to wait for an up close above the trend line. It ended up that I did wait for an up close because I hadn't really noticed it, but I got long right over here. I believe I got long at 96.18. 96.18 is where I got long, and I took profit up here at 96.28. That's how I got the 2 points this morning. Not a lot of trading in here. That was pretty much it. For a day on crude oil, that was pretty slow. All right. I didn't take any trades on the Russell. Not to say that nothing's set up. There were a lot of setups this morning right in here. Right after the open, I missed all of them. Right after the open, I missed all that. It happened, it happened fairly quickly. You can see Russell's selling off right here. But that was the Russell. This is going to be a quick recap. I didn't take that many trades, so there's not that much to talk about. But on gold in here, there were a couple of interesting spots on gold in here. Now, you can see I took that trade right in there on the gold. And did I only take one trade on gold? I thought I took two. Anyway. No, wait a minute. I had a break even there, a break even here, and a break even on the other crude. So I only did take one trade on gold. What we're looking for here was we had the bearish cross, the pull away from the BBC, the pull back up and test of the BBC with a down close. Now this is just like the trade we took on crude. In this case, the cycle was red and headed down, so we shorted right here, and it dropped down to here. It gave us 7 ticks profit a bunch of times, and I kept saying that I think if we break through this level right here, it's going to be explosive. And I said I put a 20-tick target on it. My entry was up here at 1605.4. I'm sorry, 1606.4 was my entry. Okay? And it dropped down to here several times, giving me 7 ticks profit. And, we closed down below the MA1. That's when I moved my stop to break even. It came back up here, stopped me out at break even, tested this level one more time, and then it dropped right through it, right down to that 20-tick target that I had put on it. At 1606.4. Now, I had also said that I thought it was going to get down to 1603. I think I said 1603.7. I may have said 6. I don't know. I did say something about it, about this level, and it got all the way down here. I might have said 6. It got within a tick of what I was looking at. And I was telling everyone when this was happening over here. Or was it right here? This level here, 1603.7 right here. When this was happening, I said when it breaks through the 1603.7, it looks like it's going to be explosive for probably 10 ticks, and it did. I mean, it broke this level, and it went right down 11 ticks in like 2 seconds down here. And then it consolidated a bit, and it gave some opportunity on the long side. And then we went into our break, and on the break, it had some opportunity on the short side. Okay. That is that. That's all there was for gold. We had one break-even trade there on gold. Now, unfortunately, the markets just didn't provide us with a lot of opportunity this morning. Not as much as they normally do. I tried to take the time to go over the setups a little bit slowly. The NQ had some opportunity this morning. We didn't take any trades on the NQ. We don't even have an NQ DOM up this morning. But it had a shorting opportunity right in here, right after the open. On this move up right here, it had... Right in here, it had a long opportunity. Right there. On that up close, had a long opportunity. Had another one right here on this up close. Alright. Had a short opportunity. Well, right in here was the first one. And then it had a follow-up short opportunity right in here. Because the cycle was still red. Alright. Changed directions, and it had a long opportunity right in here on this up close. And changed directions again, had a short opportunity on the down close right here. This only went about 4 ticks. Had another one over here. You need the close below the trend line on this one. Again, only about 4 ticks. Had one here on the long side. Once you get your MA1 crossing up above the BBC with the space and a pullback and test to the BBC with the up close right there, there was some opportunity in there, and that was the end of the morning session. Right now, it's setting one up. If you had a down close right here, you see the cycle is still red. We have the bearish divergence. So if you had a down close on the current bar, that would do it. We didn't take any trades on the ES. I think there were a couple this morning. Let's see, were there? I thought right in here on this little ride up right here, there were a couple of opportunities. Oh, that's a 10,000 contract. That's why I'm not seeing it. Right in here on the 4-tick range. Let's see. Right in here. This is what I highlighted. You could have gotten long right in here on this up close right there, right up to the weekly trading zone. That was pretty much it. You know, the divergence is the wrong way in here to be going long, so there was no opportunity in there. Over here on the NQ, you see how we pulled through the BBC? We still have red on the cycle, but on the close of this bar, that's going to be blue. So for that trade, you're going to be needing a trend line like that, right? You're going to look to close below the trend line, down close below the trend line. Let's see, natural gas had a couple of little opportunities in here. The one that I tried to enter was right here, and I didn't fill before it already moved up a couple bars. All right, there was one over here that turned around, and one in here that turned around. I hadn't really paid that much attention to it. I was kind of going to it when everybody told me about it. Same thing over here on the yen. I wasn't paying that much attention to the yen either. There was a test of the BBC with a down close right here. Didn't put in a lower low, changed directions, came back down, really had nothing in there after that. Now, the thing that really took off after the break this morning was the soybeans. Look at these soybeans. The opportunity on the soybeans, you had to have the divergence, so the opportunity didn't come until right in here. All right, this is where it happened. There. All right, there was one there, and another one right here. These were the spots where you might have been able to get in on this move up on the soybeans. All right, the rest of it right now, it's just looking a little bit... Well, it's got bearish divergence, and it's trading above the BBC, so there's not much you can do in there. We looked at it a little bit in here, but we didn't do anything, okay, anywhere in here. But that was a big move up for the soybeans that happened right after the break. Let's see, I think that pretty much covers it. All right. Kyle. Which number do you want there, Kyle? The number for us or the number for Daniel's trading? I guess I'll have to type it into him because his audio is acting up. All right. That's pretty much it, guys. That's
I'll
where things stand on the morning session. Right? Okay. Right in here on crude oil right now, if you take a look at that, there's a trend line. Here's a bearish divergence. Here's a test of the BBC. You would need a down close in there. A down close. Okay. That's the crude oil. This is the Russell. The Russell's going to give some divergence on an up close on the current bar. All right, you would need that to be able to start to draw a trend line anyway. Gold's got nothing. Nothing here on the NQ either. You see how the black line crossed above the green? So there's no trade in there. It's been like this all morning. Just hasn't been a lot of opportunity. A couple of them here and there. And we got our 2 points and we got out. So let's see, where does that put us on the month? On the month, we are plus $1,790 per contract. All right, we're plus $1,790 on the month per contract. And we hit our 2-point target every day except one so far this month. On February 7th, we didn't hit our 2-point target. All right, that is where things stand. If you have not taken a free trial with us, go to www.cfrn.net/apply, sign up for the free trial, and we'll, in the free trial, we'll give you 5 business days in our live trading room where you get to watch us put all these trades on live, or at least tell you about them as they're setting up, and you get to download the software, you get to download the charting package, all our indicators, so you can really take it for a good test run. Now, if you take the trial with us, take the trial, show up at the trial, download the indicators, put it on your desktop. If you have any troubles with it, you know, you can call 866-928-3310, and they will help get you set up. Okay, again, that's 866-928-3310. You can give them a call, and they'll help you. They'll help get you set up. If they can't do it, then send us an email at support@cfrn.net. Okay, support@cfrn.net. All right, that's it. That's all we got, guys. I'm going to wrap up my recording here, and then we can head on out. There we go. Recording
all right.
Is stopped.
Very good. Thanks, Michael.
All right, no problem.
Okay. All right, well, have a good afternoon. You got to take
thanks.
Care of what you got to do there, and I'll talk to you this afternoon or see you in the morning, I guess.
Okay, sounds good, Dwayne.
All right,
sounds good. All right, everyone, take care.
All right, guys, you can add billionaire investor Dan Loeb to the list of hedge fund managers who have bailed on Apple recently. Loeb's Third Point Capital, which held 710,000 shares of Apple in the third quarter, unloaded them all in the fourth quarter, according to the latest SEC filing. The company is the latest in a rapidly extending conga line of hedge funds that divested their Apple holdings following a decline in the company's share price. Among the other money management outfits selling off their stakes in Apple, Lone Pine sold all of its 805,000 shares in the fourth quarter. Viking Global sold 1 million shares. Eaton Park Capital sold 250,000 shares. Omega Advisors and Jana Partners divested their stakes of 266,000 and 143,000, respectively. Now, that's a noteworthy exodus from Apple, which has long been a favorite hedge fund stomping ground. But as IronFire Capital founder Eric Johnson pointed out, shouldn't come as much of a surprise given concerns around the fiscal cliff at the end of last year. All these reports coming out today are as of December 31st, and the holdings could have been sold weeks before that, according to Jackson. It was only prudent to sell the biggest and most liquid company in the world days before the fiscal cliff deadline. These hedge funds knew that if the politicians messed up the cliff, other investors would sell their Apple shares as if it were the nearest ATM. So the argument there is that the selling of the Apple shares had nothing to do with Apple and everything to do with Congress. And those funds all likely exited their positions with significant profits, having bought into Apple years earlier. So the exodus we're seeing isn't so much evidence of a loss of faith as it is of calculated fund management. Even now, there are plenty of funds that retain positions in Apple and others that are raising them. David Einhorn's Greenlight Capital, which is currently sparring with Apple over its plan to eliminate preferred stock from the company charter, raised its holding to 1.3 million shares from 1.2 million. And George Soros more than doubled his stake in Apple in the fourth quarter, adding 99,118 shares. Soros Fund Management now holds 183,976 shares of Apple stock in total. Danica Patrick, the GoDaddy girl, lady, woman, race car driver. Well, Danica is the first, during her first full season in NASCAR, got off to a very fast start as she won the pole position for next weekend's Daytona 500. She's the first woman to ever win a pole position for a Sprint Cup race. Patrick had been the fastest car in practice and it carried over to Sunday's qualifying. You can see video on Fox Sports. In the video, Fox Sports compared Danica's qualifying lap to that of four-time champion Jeff Gordon, who finished second in qualifying. While Gordon gets into turn one first, Patrick kept her car low and doesn't bounce around as much as Gordon, and by turn three, she took the pole position. All right, we've talked from time to time on this show about welfare and food stamps and how we feel about them. All right. Now, economists and many policymakers generally agree that our tax and transfer systems should promote opportunity, work, savings, and education rather than consumption. The problem is these programs often penalize people for earning an extra dollar of income. Rather than promoting work and savings, these implicit taxes punish such otherwise positive behavior. Now, these penalties occur in TANF, T-A-N-F, which was formerly welfare, and SNAP, which was formerly food stamps, Medicaid, the new health exchange subsidy, Pell Grants, student loans, and even unemployment compensation. The tax code also is loaded with disincentives to work, save, and study. They include PEP and PEAS. These are reductions in tax allowances for personal exemptions and itemized deductions, child tax credits, and the earned income tax credit. These implicit taxes combined with explicit taxes to create incentives for many households that are often inefficient and inequitable, to say nothing of just plain strange. At some income levels, families face prohibitively high penalties for moving off of assistance. For instance, a single worker with children could face a steep cut in child care assistance simply for accepting a higher paying job or for getting a raise. Now imagine going to work every day and having to perform subpar to make sure you don't get the raise, because if you do, you'll lose your child care. Now, because the raise is not enough to pay for the child, and if the raise were enough to pay for the child care, so be it. That's great. But in many cases, it's not. So, do you talk to your boss? Do you say, hey, I need to get that raise under the table? Well, that's not American. That's tax evasion. You can't do that, right? For some, the rapid phase-out of benefits can more than offset the additional take-home pay. Asset tests in means-tested programs create similar barriers to savings. One way couples avoid some of these penalties or taxes is to not get married. Indeed, this strategy is probably the single major tax shelter for low and moderate income households with children. Our tax and welfare system favors those who consider marriage to be optional, to be avoided if it raises taxes or reduces benefits, but embraced if it comes with a financial bonus. The losers tend to be those who consider marriage a social or religious necessity. These high rates and marriage penalties occur partly because of the piecemeal fashion in which they are developed. Designing benefit packages more comprehensively could greatly improve both the incentives families face and the quality and choice of the benefits that they reserve. Now, I've heard this for years from people who, you know, if I do good, if I achieve, if I show some success, I'm going to be penalized in some other manner. Now, again, these are folks who are probably on some type of government assistance, and your argument, and perhaps mine too, is that those individuals should be doing everything possible to move towards self-sufficiency and away from the government assistance. I agree. Although not all cases are created equal, and some people are there because of choices they made, and some people are there not from any choice that they made. It could be anything from a scandalous husband who just disappeared and doesn't pay child support, doesn't pay the bills. It could be health issues. It could be an accident. It could be any number of things. All we know for sure is that our system, as it's written right now, doesn't provide the incentive to get up, get busy, and go to work that we would hope that it would, that we would like to see. Best Buy, on the other hand, has a win-win for retail shoppers. They have officially announced their plans to implement their holiday price matching policy year-round beginning March 3rd. Now, if this pans out, then you never have to go anywhere else to buy anything other than Best Buy, right? That's what it sounds like. What this means is that those looking to pick up their favorite goodies across nearly all categories of products that Best Buy offers, except for items like phones, which are purchased via a contract, will be able to price match against online retailers like Amazon and Newegg, just to name a few. In a release, Best Buy comments that the move allows the company to end the practice known as showrooming, or where customers come in, browse through a retail location to look at the items, pick them up, hold them, and then go home and buy them, or on the way home, buy them from an online retailer for a cheaper price. Now, with a low price guarantee, Best Buy says our customers will have the best of both worlds when they shop BestBuy.com or come into a Best Buy store. They'll get unbiased service from our blue shirts and support for the life of their product, while also knowing they have a low price guarantee on nearly every item. This guarantee is available on BestBuy.com and at more than 1,000 Best Buy big box stores and more than 400 Best Buy mobile standalone stores in the U.S. as well as on the telephone. So if you're going to buy something electronic, Best Buy says if they carry it, they'll meet or beat any price that you find on the internet. Hotmail, rest in peace. For many of you, your very first email account, if it wasn't AOL, it was Hotmail. That was Microsoft's first web-based email service. Sort of an odd name. I always kind of wondered about that. But it was wildly popular. But as of Tuesday, Microsoft has begun switching Hotmail accounts to Outlook.com. Starting immediately, Microsoft will upgrade every Hotmail user to Outlook. The upgrade is seamless and instant for Hotmail customers. Your password, contacts, everything will stay exactly the same. Now, the number of active accounts on Outlook.com grew to 60 million in just 6 months during its preview period. Microsoft is letting users connect to Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter through Outlook.com. Now, probably the only feature that I find interesting about the new Outlook email service, it will allow you to send hundreds of photos and videos in a single message. Think about that, because you've all tried to send, you know, five pictures in an email and it exceeded the limit, or one video. According to this press release, Outlook.com will allow you to send hundreds of photos and videos in a single message. I'm not sure how they're going to pull that off, but we'll find out. And Hotmail, rest in peace. Launched in 1996, it was among the very first web-based email services. And some of you might remember, way back in the early days of Hotmail, somebody forgot to renew the domain. It expired over a weekend, and a user went and renewed it for them, for Microsoft, so that people would not be without their email for the weekend. And all the guy ever got from Microsoft was a thank you. I'm serious. That's a true story. Google hit $100 a share for the first time in history today. The stock has been on a tear this year, soaring 13% year-to-date. Apple, on the other hand, is down 14% year-to-date. What's driving Google? It seems like there is unbridled optimism about its long-term future, as well as more confidence in the near term. Google's search business, which seemed potentially vulnerable for years, has taken the best shots of Microsoft, mobile, the U.S. government, and now Facebook, and it appears to be as strong as ever. Google owns the lucrative search market, and there appears to be nothing on the horizon to disrupt it. On the very distant horizon, Google's early efforts in self-driving cars and Google Glass seem like very radical innovations, but they appear that they could be very close to paying off. The person leading Google now, Larry Page, has proven that he knows what he's doing. For a while, Wall Street didn't know what Page was going to do. Instead of being a crazy man who burns money on moonshots, he's reorganized Google to be more focused. His moonshots still exist, but they've been targeted to things like self-driving cars, Google Fiber, and buying Motorola. Now, these could make investors nervous, but Page has been relatively disciplined in his approach to each of these moonshots. The bottom line on Google, there's no company in a better position to capture what's next and what's new in technology. Google's software is getting sharper and more responsive. Its services are excellent, and while it doesn't have much hardware experience, it's doing all that it can to change that. We got to hope the Google Glass works better than the Chromebooks. Those have not had the greatest of reviews. If you've used one, perhaps your company bought some and maybe you got one. If you've used a Chromebook, I'd like to hear your experience. Pop onto the show, type it into the chat box, or if you would like, you could send an email to support@cfrn.net. I've not gotten my hands on one, but apparently there's a keyboard and there's the internet. And according to Google, that's really all you need. So that's their story, and apparently they're sticking to it. All right, let's get the chart switched back over to me, and then we'll head right out to Las Vegas, Nevada, and talk to Mr. David Williams from PageTrader.com. So, stand by. Don't touch your radio dial. We'll be right back with David from PageTrader. Again, Robin will not be with us today. She'll be back tomorrow. We did have a great Coach's Corner on Friday. I'll get that podcast uploaded for you this afternoon.
You're listening to CFRN, a community of believers who trade for a living. To learn more about who we are, what we do, and how we do it, call toll-free 1-866-928-3310, and we'll send you out a no-obligation information kit absolutely free. 866-928-3310.
Good morning, Dwayne.
David, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and good morning, Michael, if he's still there.
Nope, Michael's gone.
And good, all right, well, good morning to everybody, all the listeners. I hope everybody had a wonderful, really enjoyable weekend, holiday weekend. I did.
Did you? What'd you do?
Well, first of all, the weather has been very nice here in Las Vegas. It's starting to, you can kind of sense that there's some spring in the air. It's still wintertime. There's no question, but, you know, just a little bit of a shift here or there, getting little bits and pieces of it. The weather's just been nice. It's been relaxing to be outside of the house, and it's crisp and cool, but it's easy to deal with, and I just had a nice, relaxing weekend. So hope you did, too, and I hope everybody spent some time doing whatever it is they, you know, aren't doing during the day here with, because these markets, you get your head wrapped around them, and then you do need some time to unwrap your head from them. Takes a little time to undo, to unwind from this for a little bit. And then, I don't know if those of you who have traded for some period of time have noticed that even though you've been trading for a long time, perhaps maybe a number of years, if you step away from the markets for 4 or 5 days, you know, it takes a little time to get back into it. You've kind of already drifted away from having that sharp, you know, immediate focused memory and view and everything else. So yeah, it's nice to get away, and of course it all comes back after you get here, and sometimes you end up seeing things that you don't normally see. Obviously we've talked about this so many times, but I really like the idea of trying to look at things differently and seeing if you can see something that you might not have seen, and sometimes you don't have to make the effort at all. Sometimes you just do see something differently, and you go, hey, I hadn't thought of that before, and you best write it down, because a lot of times I wish I could have some of the ideas that I've had in the past that I didn't write down, because you might have just visited a very, very obscure little location mentally in your mind where you saw this thing and you think, oh, that's so obvious, I'll remember that, and gosh, you don't. And so it's a really good idea to write your ideas down, even if it does really feel like, no, I won't have any problem remembering this one, you know. And that idea might just be an idea to explore another idea, to say, right, hey, let's check this thing out. But mm-hmm. I've forgotten a lot of those, unfortunately, and that leaves you frustrated, and you know you can't quite get back to that place to remember it, and so on. So that's something that I would suggest people do, is if you have new ideas, write them down and then review them. If you have your little iPhone or your Android, they've got that little notepad type of thing in there, and you can write on that. It really helps. So has helped me.
Yeah, and there's a lot of note-taking apps for both the iPhone and the Android, yeah, that will sync across all your devices. So you jot the note into your iPhone, but when you get back to your desktop, it's there waiting on you.
Yeah. So when somebody says, you know, do you want to write an idea down? You say, well, let me think about that. That's a little
humor.
Pretty
funny. Yeah.
Not bad. Yeah. It's early. Yeah. Give me a few minutes. We'll get
the warm up.
We'll get. It's a warm up. That's right. We want to warm the crowd up. So, what about you, Dwayne? What did you do with your weekend?
Oh, we took it easy. Just my son had his cousin over for I don't know. Do boys call it a sleepover? I guess they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that and had fun and played video games and did stuff 10-year-old kids do. And we hid out in the other room and just covered up, you know.
Oh.
There you go.
Well, that's nice. That's very nice. Well, let's see. If you want, we can get right into the markets, and we'll find our way one way or to the other.
You know,
the price
the price of lumber is approaching all-time highs, which
I'm aware of that.
You know, there are those who say now. The last time lumber got outrageously priced, the housing market collapsed. But this time, we're coming out of a collapsed housing market.
Right.
This time it should, you know, it may be have the opposite effect, whereas it's starting to guide it out to give some indication that that market is starting to wake up. At the height of the housing boom, right before the crash was in, lumber was actually trading at less than what it cost to produce it. And in hindsight, people look back and go, wow, that should have been a huge, you know, tell right there. There should have been a big, you know, red flag, a warning signal that something was not right. And we look back now and go, yeah, boy, sure wasn't. Wasn't right at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've been watching lumber, and the price of lumber, having gone up, has dramatically affected the cost to the builder. And they have a set of problems that they have to deal with now, one of which is that there's more demand than there is supply. And so one of the reasons that lumber, if you want to look at it fundamentally, one of the reasons it's up is because home building has gone through the roof, new home construction. So when they're demanding all this lumber and the lumber supply is limited, lumber goes up. And so the housing market and the lumber market are very intimately related. And you can see that if you look at the quarterly chart, you may or may not have the chart right there, Dwayne, but when you get a chance, anybody can look at the market, and you can take a look at going back. This is just so you can see it easily on a quarterly chart of lumber, and you can see that the market had made a low back in the second quarter of and the third quarter of 2011.
I have no idea what the symbol for lumber is.
On yours it may be LBH, but I don't think your symbols are the same. I wish they would standardize symbols. That would be seems like that would be a really good thing.
I got a random length lumber.
Okay. Well, and I just want to mention to people that one of the reasons that this was one of the backdrop reasons was that when we in late 2011 and early 2012 were talking about the market had bottomed and so on, that we wouldn't see those lows for 50 years, the lows being the lows that the housing prices had gotten to a low that I believe we'd not see virtually again, you know, in our lifetime, was because in part of the lumber market. The lumber market had been advancing and retreating and so on. And for those of you that have reflected wave, you can go in and see the reflected wave bottom made in late 2011. And that reflected wave bottom, this was a longer term bottom, was a backdrop reason for the call that we had talked about on the radio, saying that the bottom was in, and that if you were in a position to do so, that you would want to take advantage of the housing market, because housing prices would almost certainly start to go up from there. The other thing was that the housing market itself, not the suppliers to the housing market, but just the housing market itself, had gone down tremendously, and the way that it got down to the final, what we thought would probably be the final lows, you know, you can never be 100% sure about any of this. You know, you have to take your position at some point, and you even when you take it, you can't be 100% sure. What you can be is very sure, but, you know, whatever percentage very is, it isn't 100%. So you never get the 100% certainty.
Right.
But you don't need 100% certainty in order to, I guess the word speculate would be one, but or to invest wisely. Speculation has almost a little bit of a negative connotation to me, but you know, investing is probably a better word. So anyway, so the lumber bottom and then the fact that the housing market had gone down and then bounced a little and then continued on down, in my mind, it had put in a very important bottom. And in our market in Las Vegas, we were down two-thirds of the price high. I mean, that's just a wipeout of all that equity. And anyway, so for those of you who got in the housing market, if you did, back then in the beginning of 2012, your property values are up decently, substantially. There's no question about it if you had bought something new. And the boom is not over. I see, if for those that are interested, I see, in spite of whatever government regulation comes upon the land here with regard to real estate and the fiscal cliff and so on, the housing boom is going to continue unabated through 2013. It will not even take a breather. It's going to go straight up from where we are now. Not even a day of sideways. That's what housing is going to do. So, in other words, it's going to continue doing what it's been doing. There are some regulations and there are some new potential laws that surround the administration that could have an effect on banking, could have an effect on all kinds of things. But in the end, I believe that 2013 is going to be a very strong year. So even though prices have gone up, they have not reached a peak. And one number that I think you might want to think about in terms of housing is that there's no doubt in my mind that before the current rally in housing, which started in the, you know, the late 2011s, and before that's over, we will see, we will be very comfortably trading, so to speak, in homes at $150 a square foot. So that means a 2,000 square foot house will be priced at $300,000. Now, there's going to be some variance in there because a newer home, you know, or a brand new home might be a little bit more than that with options and whatnot. But they're not at those prices now. You're not seeing $150 a square foot, at least here in Las Vegas, and you may see it in some areas already. But I am talking about specifically Las Vegas, but in general, if you're not there yet, we're going to be at $150 a square foot without a doubt. Not 100% certainty, but I don't have any doubts before this rally is over. Now, when I started looking at the market myself, the stuff was down at $78 to $80 a square foot on a new home. So we're talking about literally doubling the square foot price of housing since late 2011. It's really just a year and a quarter later, and I think you're going to see those prices sooner rather than later. You may even see them this year in 2013 if you haven't already. So out here in Las Vegas, we're already at 108, 115, and so on. But I don't see any stoppage of this with all the forces behind it, the banks that Dwayne has talked about with regard to lending. You know, the lending is going to open up more than it has. In other words, people, there's going to be some kind of program for people who got hurt in their houses where they could possibly rebuy. You know, somebody's going to come up with other stuff that keeps this rally going. So don't say to yourself, it's already happened, it's too high, I can't buy. Don't say that. What you should say is, you know, if it's prudent and you can do it, how can I take advantage of this? Because it's not done yet. So anyway, the lumber market is a big part of this, and it is running. And I was just going to mention this. The thing I was going to say is that, you know, they suffered through a lot. This is the classic thing. You're going to see it. You're going to hear it, just like you do in every case. The oil industry was down at $10, $12, $15 for nearly my entire adult life. And as soon as the market took off and rallied to its, you know, unbelievable highs of $149 or whatever dollars it was, everyone was screaming that it was all part of a big, you know, what scheme to get oil prices higher. Well, where were all those scheming people for my whole adult life? If it's just so easy for them to do it, how come they didn't do it all that time that I've been alive? We didn't see prices anything like that. It's just because the markets are actually real. They're not driven by a group or a bunch of people. There actually is a real market there of buyers and sellers. And so having said all that, the same thing is going to be said about the housing market. The banks are running the prices up. The this is running the prices up. The that is running the prices up. And I want to stop you now. The prices go up because it's a real market. That's why the prices go up. There's nobody running it. There isn't a bank that's running this market. The housing prices went down. I didn't hear you telling me it was a scam when they ran down. Who was running it down? Who was the group that ran prices down? Same thing when they ran up in the bubble. No one could believe the prices continuing to move higher and higher because it was a runaway market. So you can't have it both ways. The markets go up and down. They do it over a great long number of years, especially something as slow as the housing market, which is, you know, it's kind of a slow boat in terms of price movement. But except when they crash, of course. But even then, they don't crash as fast as the futures markets do. So anyway, it's a real market. That's what's moving this. Yes, the banks want to take advantage of this as much as they can, and they will, and that's all part of it. But they're not driving it. What's driving it is the real world. That's what's driving prices back up, and prices are going to continue higher than most people think they're going to go. And, you know, if you're going to buy a house to either live in it or to rent it or whatever you're going to do, understand that it's a real market. That's what makes it good, is that it's a real market. It isn't, driven by one group of people. The Rothschilds aren't running it. The Illuminati are not running it. In your dream world, those things are happening because you maybe don't know how to face the real world where real things happen. But this is a real market, and it's going to continue to go up for the year, at least for the year of 2013 here, at least as far as I'm concerned. And I think it's got a lot of opportunity in it for people who can shake off the Illuminati and the others that are driving every war we've ever had, every up and down in the market, the people that have run everything beautifully without an error since day one, if that's where you're coming from. You know, snap out of that and take advantage of some of the things that are happening in front of you, one of which is the blue moon that we've talked about, which is low interest rates and low housing. Now, having said that, low housing is the one that's starting to break the blue moon, the long wave that we've talked about where we've said, you know, this is really unusual that you see very, very low interest rates and you see very, very low housing prices. It's not going to last forever. And the break has already happened. It's not the interest rates. It's housing. Housing ended up starting to move up now. It's not over. It'll continue to go up, and there's plenty of room for continued opportunity here. But housing is the one that broke it. The blue moon got broke by housing. It's starting to move up. It's going to continue to move up. Interest rates will probably stay low through much of the remainder of this year. So housing is the one. And then when interest rates start to move up, when the government steps aside and stops, trying to run the market, you know, the very thing that the Illuminati and all these other hidden families, the Rothschilds, supposedly are doing. It's right out in front of you there. The government said, we're going to go buy $60 billion worth of U.S. 30-year Treasury bonds. You don't have to have a conspiracy. They're out telling you that. You don't need any special dark rooms with candles and black light posters of Led Zeppelin. You just need to listen to what the government says. They're going to buy $60 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds every month for quite some time. When they stop that, that activity, or however it ends, one way or the other, the bond market is going to then also continue to go down instead of up, and then you're going to have a much more normal market. You're going to have housing prices at pretty decent prices. The interest rates are going to start to go up, and we're going to be out of the blue moon phase entirely, and we'll be back to a more normal potential for economic activity. I honestly believe, and I've said this before, that even though the interest rates are beautifully low, I don't really believe the economy can return. there isn't enough incentive in many, many ways for the economy to return to full steam without higher interest rates. So part of, you know, part of having a booming economy is having higher interest rates. So those are, when they return, I think you're going to start seeing, putting the administration aside and all that, you're going to see the economic picture pick up some more. So I don't like the idea of high interest rates, but unless you want to just, you know, give everybody all the same stuff and tell everybody they can live in the same box and they, you know, all that, unless you want to do that, everything's subject to the markets. And America's done very well on a, for lack of a better word, a free market. You know, are there people and forces that try to control it? Absolutely. It happens all the time. That's part of a free market, is that people will try to do that. And once in a great, great while, there can be a corner on a market. It really does happen for once in a while. It's very, very rare. It does happen. But that's the exception to the rule. The rule is that we have, for the most part, we have free markets. And so, anyway, on the positive note of all this is that the blue moon is still here, but it's gotten broken a little bit by housing now having this run. And as long as the interest rates are low, it still makes, to me, it makes tremendous sense as an investment and other ways to consider your options in real estate. And that could even be being perhaps maybe doing something with a real estate trust or getting involved in something that invests rather than you buying the home, you know, the whole thing, a fund or something. So there you are. So, the last thing I was going to mention was, this is the first thing I was going to mention, is that these home builders now who are going to be accused of scamming, running a scheme, you know, running the market along with the banks and everything else. I'm just waiting for it, because if it hasn't already out already, it's just the market. But they have a number of problems to deal with themselves now. It's a good problem, but it actually is a pretty serious problem. And here's the problem. The problem is that there's not enough supply of lumber and materials. Lumber's going up. Their costs are going up. And they don't want to sell too many houses in a single day now, because if they agree to a fixed price on that house, their problem is that the cost of building the house could literally get out of control where they won't make money. So they're actually having to limit the sales, or hoping to limit the sales of their houses. And how are they doing that? They're limiting their sales by raising their prices, because they have no other way except to say, well, we just won't sell that house and we're just going to wait and see what happens. Well, they don't want to have a customer turn away and go to somebody else, so they're simply raising the prices to assure themselves that by the time that house gets into production, which is now in many cases 6 months out, they have the same problem that the gas station owner and all these other people. See, a lot of people who have these conspiracy theories, they've lived in a bedroom all their life, and they haven't actually had to deal with some of the real things that happen to these real businesses, like gas stations. It used to be very easy to say, well, he's just hiking up his price. And we've talked about the gas station guy and the serious issues that he faces trying to buy gasoline in the future to match what the then current demand and pricing and so on is. The housing guys have that same problem. I'm not saying that they're not going to take their shots. Everybody in business does. But what I'm saying is that they actually have a pretty serious problem right now. They want to sell homes, but they don't want to sell too many of them right now, because the very foundation of the home itself, the building materials itself, those prices and their whole way of being able to guarantee themselves a profit has suddenly sort of ran away from them. So they have to raise the price to slow down the buying, and in doing so, it hasn't worked. Out here in Nevada, it's just an onslaught of people buying homes. They raise the price and they just keep buying them. So they have issues to deal with. So that was my whole thing, is that they've got issues just like everybody else in business does, even though they're good issues. They're good for them, but they could actually agree with you to sell you a house at this price, and because they can't build it now for 6 months because there's so many in the pipeline for them to build and it takes time to manage all the workers and so on, by the time they get around to building your house, much of their anticipated profit could have been chewed up by the changes in pricing. So that's one of the reasons that prices go up, because they're anticipating that type of thing. They're protecting themselves. They want to slow down the onrush of buyers if they can, but if they're going to take a buyer, they're only going to take one who agrees to a higher price. So, you know, it's just, this is how business really works. So you know, if the Illuminati are doing anything, I'd like to know what it is, because I see real markets at work here. I see real forces driving markets up and down.
Now, you're referring to the housing market, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the housing market's recovering as we would
yes.
hope, but I know you're jokingly referring to the Illuminati, but I mean, what conspiracy would be afoot here that people would?
Well, the same conspiracy that would be afoot any time anything changes in a big way. Okay. People come up with conspiracies. The housing market crashed. They had a conspiracy. The housing market ran up in the bubble. They had a conspiracy. Now the market is coming back, and I'm saying, just wait. You're going to see more of that. This boom in housing that's coming is going to be surrounded by more conspiracy theories about why it's happening. And this is really just how markets work. Supply and demand. You know, the people that are buying these homes aren't the Illuminati. They're regular people. I've seen them. I'm dealing with them. I know several home builders here. I participated myself. There's real people coming in and buying up homes. There's real demand there. Why? What were you saying?
I was just curious. I mean, I agree. I see a market that, you know, got overheated and, you know, imploded on itself, and now I see it coming back to life, and people have to have a place to live, and so, yeah.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I'm just saying, just wait and see. You'll see. It'll be all over the internet when housing, you know, really starts really smoking. You know, they'll be, yeah, okay, this is, you know, here we go again. It's always that, you know, it's always something. And in many cases, it's just a matter of ignorance that people don't realize that there's more than one thing in the world going on. And there's a lot of forces at work that can make this stuff happen. One thing that people don't realize, and I just want to talk about just the housing just for a second, then we'll get on to the regular markets. But you have to understand that in order for the bank, when you go to the bank to give you the loan, whoever you are, the bank isn't going to give you a loan without knowing what the value of the house is. And the value of the house can't be just named by the builder. The builder doesn't have that ability to just name whatever price he wants. He could, but he would run into a problem. And the problem is that there's a little guy who comes out and checks and he assesses the real value of your home. And he works independently. And the banks look to him, he's a licensed guy, they look to him to tell them what the value of the house is. So the builder wants a higher price, but I forgot the name, it's not the assessor, but the guy who does
the appraiser.
Appraiser, thank you. The guy that does the appraisal really is the cornerstone of what the price of the house is. So even though the builders might see greater demand early on in a bull market, the appraisers are still working with numbers 3 and 4 months ago or 6 months ago, and they don't want to lose their job. They don't want to have a bank coming back to them saying, hey, you said this property is worth this much. We've loaned it out. The deal went bad, and now we find out it's really only worth this much. So the value that the builder wants to assign to his house, it isn't just he wakes up and says, let's add $3,000. He has to consider whether or not the appraiser is going to believe in that number and appraise it at that number. Otherwise, the person coming in to buy the house will not get his loan. So that's the problem. The house has to appraise at the price. Otherwise, the buyer would have to make up the difference. And in many cases, people are financing homes because they can't make up the difference. So there's a lot of forces at work that both restrict housing prices from going up, i.e. appraisers, and also help prices going up, i.e. the lumber market is running, and other supplies and things like that. So there's a lot going on in the market going up. The guy just can't, like we, I could just get online and raise the price of my product, and you either pay it or you don't.
Right.
But a builder cannot do that. A builder can do it, but he may run into a whole bunch of problems that it won't appraise. And if it doesn't appraise, the bank won't loan the money. And the vast majority of homes are financed.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of issues there. So don't just think the builders are just running it here, because they can't. They've been able to run it up some because there is real demand. And the appraisers have really seen the demand, and now they're making their, the judgment. And, you know, it's a federal crime for an appraiser to give a false value to a bank in order to obtain a loan for himself or for anybody. So there's real consequences to them not doing their job well. So I'm just pointing all that out, that there's a lot more going on in the process than simply people deciding to charge you more money, making you mad and, you know, or whatever. As a matter of fact, on this radio program, we've done as much as we can, Dwayne included, of course, to tell people that to take advantage, you know, of this situation while it lasted. Because in the really long wave, what we just went through is a really, really short period that can't last for very long. And so the housing prices of, you know, they're the ones that sort of broke the blue moon phase. But like I said, I think there's a lot more coming on the upside. And with that, Dwayne, we'll unless you have anything else you'd like to throw in on that, we'll scoop over to the markets that move a little faster than the housing market.
John made a comment. He's in Knoxville. He said the price of drywall there is up 30% so far this year. So, yeah, all the building products, lumber, all of that stuff, prices are coming back to life. I mean, it's been a very depressed market for a number of years, and that's all part of the boom-bust cycle.
Right. Exactly. So those people, the drywall makers, they wouldn't be able to raise their price unless there was a tremendous demand for drywall. And there is a tremendous demand for drywall right now. They're running them. So I don't know if they have drywall futures, but they certainly have lumber futures. Lumber, by the way, is not a bad market to take a look at sometime. Lumber is somewhat thinner, but boy, you know, I haven't looked at the volume of it, but it actually trades pretty good. It's one of those markets that you better use risk protection and all that, like any of these markets. So,
yeah, it's not a very
volatile.
It's not a very liquid market.
No, it isn't. But by looking at it, it by my eye, just for me, and I think other people have seen as well, it trades well. But I agree with you; it's limited because of its the volatility, not the volatility, but the volume. So, okay. So if you want to, Dwayne, let's take a look at some of our real markets that we have that we all trade in. One of which is the S&P 500.
Just to give an idea of how illiquid the market is. There's 17 contracts here on the ask side, and then 1, 2, 3, 4 positions away, there's 3 contracts on the bid side, and that's all that's showing. That's now that market. I don't know what hours they're open, what hours they trade, but that's what's left sitting at the end of the day if the market is closed. Now, Bert, if you're there, you can type it in for me.
Yeah, actually, Dwayne, it's limit down.
It's limit down today?
Yeah.
Off this move right here? Okay. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
Hey, David.
Hey, Bert, how are you doing?
Good. Yeah, right now it's limit down, so it trades from, 5 o'clock to 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, around the clock to 4 o'clock the following afternoon. But as you pointed out, it's thinly traded. It's not uncommon for this to go up or down, limit up, limit down. So it could be very painful if you're stuck in a position.
Mm-hmm. And what does it take to make it go limit down or limit up?
10 points.
10 points? Because it looks like, based on the size of these candles compared to this one, it could happen quite often.
Exactly. So I would deter anyone from doing it unless you have some risk capital in your account, that's for sure.
I remember myself, this is many, many years ago, where lumber went limit up 14 days in a row. They just wouldn't stop. And I don't know what people do I suppose there is something you can do. You can be long on the other side. But you have to be very careful with all markets, and you have to use stops and so on. But these thinner markets can really move.
Yeah, for sure.
So, all right. So, if Bert, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I just want to. I was in the background here. I saw that, and I wanted to point it out.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take a look at the S&P. I don't have a whole lot to add to everything that we've talked about over time. I think all kinds of indicators are going to fail. I've mentioned this for a month or more. This is a runaway market. This is not a normal market where most indicators are going to correctly call it. They're not, because the market has much larger forces at work running here. We've talked about the importance, at least in terms of staying bullish, for the market to remain above the what we feel is at least temporarily critical area, the 1515 level that was forecast last August, for the market to continue to close above that. And every day we have closed above it. I think the lowest close we've had since really running into it here, on the, actually the first day we ran into it was on February 8th, and the high was 1515. The very next day they closed at 1513, then they kind of got above it. From that point forward, we've been, you know, we've had closes at 1516, 1517, and so on. And the market has firmed up on that level. And the next level for us on the upside was this 26 and 27 level. We've had this in our support and resistance panel since February 11th, and they're reaching that now. These are the minor levels that are important, but they're minor relative to what our next, for us, bigger level is, which is the 1538 to 1540 level on the upside. So I'm expecting higher prices into March, and I believe that you know, in spite of the very, very quiet behavior and any of the little usual pullbacks, I think we're going to continue to see higher prices and further tests of some of the levels we're talking about on the upside. Now, one thing I will say is February isn't over yet. February closing the month above 1515 would be important, and, of course, closing below that would be an important issue as well. And we had sent out a report over the weekend that essentially said the market needs to break out on the upside on or before February 20th. Otherwise, we would see them declining, and that would give us a new buying opportunity. I won't go into all the details, but February 20th is Wednesday. So today they broke out to the new highs, and that, so they're acting normally in a certain way, but it's also in the bigger picture. I've said this before. You can have a market act normal on a particular time frame, but in another larger time frame, it can be doing something very unusual, like, as an example, having a runaway market, which is what we have here. So that's basically my whole take on the S&P. We're going to be seeing higher prices and be ready for them, and I think buying pullbacks and all that stuff is still the right thing to do. Dwayne, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Nope. We've had we've got about a 10-point range today, including the Globex session. Yesterday, the holiday, we always say, you know, holiday, quiet behavior, but a lot of holidays we get surprised. We see some sizable moves on light volume, but yesterday certainly was not one of those holidays. We had a swing high at 1519, a swing low at 1516, so there was a three-point range for 24 hours. But today, although it's quiet, I mean, we've inched, you know, steadily higher. We're looking for 2728 here on the upside, but other than that, no, not much to add. The volume today so far, they haven't broke a million yet. On Friday, they had some pretty decent volume. Friday, they had 1.6 million, which was the best day in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, in about 8 trading days. And we're sitting at 905,000 today. So, now, there was the big sell-off that we had Friday afternoon, and then the market bounced right back. That had to do with Walmart, and so I don't know what Walmart is doing today. Their symbol is WMT, right?
Correct.
Thanks, Bert.
Yep.
Yeah, here's Walmart.
I wasn't sure, Dwayne.
Yeah, so the gap lower. Bert, do you have any idea what the story was behind that? Was that an earnings thing? with Walmart?
No.
Or is it some kind of a labor thing?
I don't remember, Dwayne. Okay. I remember hitting the wire because everyone was looking at each other saying, what's going on? What happened?
Yeah.
And then it came across the wire, so I forget what the deal was.
Hey, look at the tail on that candle. I mean, that thing really spiked down.
Yeah.
But then it recovered, and the whole market recovered on Friday. If we go back to... That thing dropped out of nowhere. There it is right there. There's the drop, and then the following hour, it recovered, you know, 75% of the fallout. Okay, let's see. Kyle says it was leaked emails. Sales were down, according to Davis. Poor start to February, according to Donald. Okay. So that was it, guys. Whatever drag it had on the market temporarily, we can see now that the market has shrugged that right off and it's heading higher. So you want to go to gold now, Dave?
Sure. Let's take a quick look. I love those stocks. I love. I think that's a big part of what we do. And I think a lot of people may, you know, that have been in futures for a long time. And I was very much the same way. I was in futures for a long time. I never really did anything with stocks. And actually, Dane, partner of mine, is the one that got me into stocks because he was doing that himself. And that led me to start looking at them, and I really got hooked on the options with stocks, either owning the stock and having an option, or just selling the options naked. And so that's been really good. As a matter of fact, it's been one of the biggest sources for us as you know, for trading, for income that we have, because it's beautiful. You know, I mean, it's just been really, really good. Now let's take a look at gold here, because this is another one of these examples where you don't have to necessarily own the gold. You can also own the ETF and take advantage of it in that way. You know, it struck me, and Bert will remember this, our original, a few months back, our original call was that if the market broke that 1680 level, 1682 or so on, that the market would go down and complete 1600. And along the way, we had other sort of mixed indications that made us put that forecast aside, because we believed that there was strength in the market and so on, because last month, which was the month that it would normally have done so, the month of January 2013, would have been the month that we would have expected the 1600 level to have been reached, and they didn't. They got down to 1626, and I even mentioned on the program that's too far away to be considered strength. I mean, but at the same time, we took it for what it seemed like it was at the time. But now we've moved down. The market has moved lower and has completed the 1600 level. Now, this is important to us because it puts us in a position now where we believe that the month of March would now be the one that marks a very important bottom in this market. Now, having said that, we're going to take it carefully and slowly. There's a number of different price levels that are important. I won't go into all the details right now, but I do want to say that what we said originally, which was that the 1680 break would lead to 1600, they've completed, and because March is still out by a half a month or whatever, I would be cautious on the long side. I wouldn't try to take the long side just yet on this. There are some important levels that we want to see reached. And I'll give you one of them, which they've already reached, but it's 1598. This goes out in our report that we send out to the institutional people. The 1598 level, if they were able to close the month of February above that, that would be a very important thing. I think they won't do that. I think they'll probably break below it. And that brings us into the month of March. And then we'll take advantage of the gold situation. So been a little bit tricky. And they've taken a little bit more time to get down to these important levels, but that's fine. I've said this so many times. If you see some tricky behavior, let that be an encouragement for you to take your next trade, not a discouragement. So many times you see that if it isn't the way you like it, then it kind of turns you off to the whole idea, and then often it has the really big move, and you go, "Gosh, I really would have taken that. I wish I would have gotten involved." But you know, the natural psychology is, they didn't show it right to me, and I felt like maybe they weren't, you know, it wasn't my market or whatever, and then you miss the big move. And one of the things that has served me well is to take advantage of that. And I know that when I put the position on, I still to this day don't feel right or good, except that I know I'm doing something that most traders aren't doing. Because I generally feel that if it fooled or was tricky for me, it also was probably for others. And in many cases, it turns out to be very good. So I like the idea of holding on here a little bit further into March for the potential next bottom in gold here. It's possible that it'll come 1 month early and we'll have to get in at higher prices, but fair enough, we'll do that. If they do make a new low in March, you will hear me on the radio talking about our next opportunity for this, which would be on the long side. So keep that in mind. I do think they're probably going to do lower prices. I even have the price, but we can't give it all out, so... but I do know that I do think they're probably going to do lower prices before this is all over on the downside. So there you go.
Well, Friday, it dipped below 1600.
Yeah, he got down to the 1598 and 50. I think they went to 96 even. And they closed above it. And I would normally expect a bounce at the 1598. We'll see how they handle that bounce. That's going to be interesting. We'll watch over the next couple of days. We'll talk about it on the program here and we'll see. With regard to the U.S. Treasury bond market, no changes there. For those of you with Reflected Wave, you know about the February 15th / 18th top that they just put in. We've talked about this on the program. We're looking for a February bottom in the U.S. Treasury bond market. That's the reason we believe the market's going to move up into later this year because of this bottom. And so that's going to keep interest rates low for you to take advantage of, sorry to hammer it, but anybody that wants to take advantage of the housing will still have an opportunity, at least one part of the program, the blue moon is still intact, which is the low interest rates. So I don't have anything really to add to that right now. The euro... quick review on the euro. We had talked about the decline on the monthly top for February. They would decline down to 133.85. They've done that. They're trading at 133.89 right now. They're having a little bounce here. I think overall, I still expect lower prices. But one way to judge those lower prices would be that watch for any break or daily close below the 133.06 level. That might be important to set up a further decline here. There is what I call, playfully but seriously, a wild card for this market.
What market are you in?
I'm sorry?
What market?
In the euro.
Okay.
Euro.
Okay, and you're looking for, did you say, what price did you say you're trading at right now?
90 in the March euro.
Okay. All right. Yeah. For some reason, I thought I heard a different number. Yeah, that's what I've done. Okay.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so there is such a thing in our work as a wild card, and that's where there's a very important area that, even though we're quite distanced from it, it for all intents and purposes could very well be tested before this decline is over. So, I like the idea for the euro of. We're expecting a multi-day bounce here. We put that in our report. So there's going to be some upside. But I like the idea of selling short because there really could be a much larger decline into March. And that kind of ties in with the bond market. Excuse me, what was the other market we talked about with March? The gold. So that would send euro down strongly into March and potentially gold bottoming as well. That's what we call a wild card because we, instead of trading that, we're going to wait for the market to really show that something big is happening. And the starting point for us would be the 133.06 level. Maybe that's the number that you heard, Duane. If they were to close daily below that, then that could, that kind of lights the match for the potential of the wild card playing out. So, I won't give the wild card numbers out on the downside, but in technical terms, it's the hell down there. So you guys know what that is, right? Big move. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind. We'll keep an eye on this, but I do, like I say, we're expecting a multi-day bounce here off of it, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. Let's see, let's move on past the euro. The crude oil market. I don't have a lot to add, honestly, to what has already happened. We talked about it last week. The first leg of the roadmap that we had forecast is over, and we have a second leg, which would indicate lower prices in crude. It was calling for a January top. I think January made the top. We may have made a ticker. Let me see here. Well, January did make the top as it is right now. So the January top is underway. Inside and subsequent to that, anybody with reflected wave knows about the February 13th reflected wave top, which we forecast on the radio, and we had a really nice move down from that. I don't like the idea of if you're holding for the bigger move, I would not trade this. I would just hold positions and let them bounce and do whatever they're going to do. That's what I would do. Because whatever, if this thing is going to happen, it's going to happen in such a way that it would be very difficult to trade it and kind of get yourself back in. If you're already in from the February 13th top or on or around that level, good for you. And you might book a little bit, but I would definitely hold the remainder of whatever position you have for continued decline, in spite of the fact that we will probably see a bounce. So that's all I have. I don't have anything more to add to that. Let's let the market do what it does here. Let's see. Anything else of interest, Duane? The Aussie dollar. Kind of a sexy little name, the Aussie dollar, but we've talked about it.
Okay.
I don't know. Some things have sex appeal. You know, that the Aussie dollar sounds like a kind of a fun market. So anyway, we've been talking for quite some time on this market. We don't trade in it, but we have called for or said that we believe that the market would want to get down and test or attempt 101.64. This was back in December. And they've slowly worked their way down here, and recently they got down to 102 even, at least off of the monthly chart here. Let's see on the daily, we got to 102. So we've come pretty close, but not quite there yet. We've missed it by 36 ticks. It's been a pretty decent-sized move down. I'd like to see them complete it. And for those of you with reflected wave, you know about the top that was on time was February 14th for this market, and they had a nice shoot down. And today they're running back up again here. They haven't taken out the high, but we'll keep an eye on this because this market moves, and I don't see there's any reason why we shouldn't be commenting on it and trading it. So, but we'll practice with a little bit more on live radio. Okay. And see what we can do with it. And then finally, there's just a few others, Duane, I'd like to take a quick look at. You can't not notice soybeans today. They had a wonderful big move up. Another great example. I think Michael talked about it in his presentation this morning. I think that this is another good example of why this market is good, because it has big single-day moves, in many cases dramatically more volatile than the S&P right now. So this is a market I like to continue to watch. Let's see.
This thing's gone from 1432 up to 1474. That's equivalent to about a 40-point move in the S&P.
Mm-hmm. That is.
Now, I'll say that again just in case somebody thinks they might have misunderstood me. That right there today is equivalent to a 40-point move in the S&P 500.
Yeah, imagine the news that would surround, that would be on the TV if the S&P had moved 40 points. And you don't even hear about it in soybeans.
Right.
that's the kind of market you want to trade when they're not even bothering, you know, making a big deal out of it. That's a pretty volatile market. So, yeah, that's a good point. We have not seen a 40-point move in the S&P in a single day. I don't know when. It might be a year or more since we've seen something like that.
That would translate into about 400 points in the Dow.
Yeah. So, interesting.
Hey, Bert, if you're still there, what does it take for soybeans to lock limit up or down?
70 cents.
How much?
70?
70 cents.
70 cents, okay.
Okay.
Bad weather in Argentina has been announced. That's why you have such
a move. Oh, is that what happened today? Okay.
Yeah, it's weather-driven.
Okay. Quickly moving over to the dollar, Dwayne and anybody else. This isn't a forecast, and we haven't put this out, but, you know, with the dollar moving down, that pushes the euro up. We're looking for a multi-day bounce in the euro here. I wouldn't mind short positions in the dollar if you find some, and I would, if I was going to trade it, I would trade it in down to the 803 level. We're at 805.45, and well, I can't help myself, but I would expect that level rather soon. So, you know, it's not really an outright forecast. It's just that the euro's going up. I wouldn't mind trading on the short side of the dollar, and at or near 803. You know, being kind of a target for trading, so keep that in mind, and we'll keep an eye on the dollar, of course, in tied in with the euro every day, like we do all the time. Let's see, cocoa continues to go down here. This was a really, really heavy market. Heavy meaning a lot of pressure on the downside in that market. I would have liked to have been able to take advantage of that, but it just looked too weird at the time, and I, you know, what can I tell you? Copper. We've talked about copper needing to go lower, and I told people on the radio here over the last couple of weeks, we had a big thing was we had a weekly top in copper, and that the market, as long as they, and we expected them to not be able to close above $376.60 on any day until much lower prices got completed. One of the prices that I wanted to see was 365.80 or so. We didn't. I'm not sure that we mentioned that. We may have mentioned 363.95 and some of these other levels. I don't remember what we talked about on the radio, but we did talk about holding if you were short for further decline. Well, we've had that further decline now. In the last 2 days, including sort of the weekend trading, the holiday trading, we've moved down sharply. This now sets up today, February 19th, as the next important bottom for copper. So because of that, I like the idea now of considering booking something here. There still is the potential for much lower prices. But at this point, with the market having completed everything that we were looking for, and the fact that we're very close to another reflected wave bottom, anybody with reflected wave knows what I'm talking about here, then this is a good time to book something. So consider that if you were trading short, and this may be something that we can take advantage of on the upside as well once this bottom gets put in. And I think other than natural gas, which I do want to make a comment on, Dwayne, this will be the last one, unless there's any other questions, you know, we've been talking about natural gas for some time. The big move that we were talking about was them declining off of the January 18th to 20th daily top that they had. I think it was 18th to 21st or something. It was a Friday-Monday combination. And them going down to test both 317, the target was 317, and also the longer-term, more important target is $2.98. The lowest they've gotten is $3.12, so they've missed it by about 14 cents, and we're rallying pretty good today. I have forecast on the radio that we're looking for a very important bottom in this market in this month, and that last week, the week of February 11th, would possibly mark that bottom. In other words, inside the month of February, that we could scale it down and say, well, the week of February 11th would mark the bottom. Well, today's rally is a very good early sign that that is the case. So I can't give the numbers out, but I can tell you that we are looking for February to mark a very important bottom. They have not made a new low in February, and so that's the only thing from the previous month, which was at 308 or something, and we got down to 312. So we're going to wait on this before we do anything here, but we are expecting a volatile move, and this is going to be in our reports that we send out. So I think that's everything we have, and I know if Robin was here, she would be talking about soda and stuff like that, but I don't think we have anything really yet. We'll save all that until she's here. Will she be with us tomorrow, Dwayne, or do you know?
Yes, she will.
Okay. Well, there you are. Yeah. We'll wait until tomorrow to see.
She'll be here tomorrow.
We'll talk about soda a little bit more.
She'll be here tomorrow.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. And I think
guys,
that's everything we have.
There was a group of guys that took issue with the Tesla article, and so they set out this weekend to do a road trip to try to prove that it really could do it. And what's interesting is that none of them managed to – I don't know if any of them actually completed the trip. They all started.
Oh, so they wanted to prove it and then it didn't work out, or they just didn't complete it for some other reason?
Well, one guy had some kind of car trouble and, you know – It didn't have anything to do with it not being able to go the distance.
Oh, I see. Other factors, right?
Just other things factored in. I was looking for the article here. Tesla owners hit the road to prove.
Oh, Tesla owners. I got it. So people who bought the car, who believe in it, went out. Go ahead.
The group, which started out with 9 cars, drove the 353 miles from Rockville, Maryland to Groton, Connecticut. But not all of the starting 9 completed the entire drive for varying reasons. And then this guy interviewed him in some coffee shop along the way. Trying to see what some of the reasons are that they none of the road trip cars have run out of juice. But the trip was not without incident. One driver's Tesla S stopped working at the Delaware charging station due to what they believe was faulty circuitry. The owner called – oh, this was interesting. The owner called Tesla support, and a software update was pushed to his car remotely, allowing him to drive it to Milford.
That's cool.
Now, that's pretty good when they can fix your car via satellite.
Right, and that's happened, by the way, I just want to throw this in, with my Chevy Volt. They didn't fix the car, but I, at one point, I have had no problems with it, but I saw a fault code come up. This was probably 9 months ago, and you push the OnStar button, and they did a remote satellite-based diagnostic on the car and cleared the code. And so you're driving along, they said, no, we've checked your vehicle out, it's fine, and we've cleared the code.
Interesting. In total, only 4 of the original 9 drivers stuck it out for the whole trip from Rockville to Groton and back. Some opted out early on in Delaware. Another driver during the first leg of the trip chose to stay in New York and see a Broadway play. Okay.
They're easily distracted.
Apparently. One of the guys says, I think Broder's biggest problem was that he didn't charge his car fully. You wouldn't fill up your car with gas for 50 miles if you were taking a 100-mile road trip. So they're saying the guy didn't fully charge his car before. The group said their trip was not commissioned or sponsored by Tesla, although they said Tesla Vice President of Sales George Blankenship did contact them after hearing about the mission. And so that's it, yeah. They set out to prove a point and kind of didn't exactly. Well, I guess they did because some of them made the whole trip.
The car will definitely do it. All the magazines have tested it. They've vetted out the car's 300-mile range, and if you drive it heavier, it won't go the full 300, but it definitely will do what Tesla advertises that it'll do. I mean, heck, the EPA gave it a 265-mile rating. Well, you can drive from California to Las Vegas on that, and they did twice. So the car will do it. I don't know what happened with the New York Times guy, and you know, no one wants to accuse anybody, and sometimes things just happen, whatever, but the car will drive 300 miles. So there's no two ways about it. It's an easy calculation too, because it's not totally easy, but the car weighs about 4,700 pounds with a person in it and some luggage or whatever. You're inching in on 5,000 pounds, and it's got extremely good aerodynamics, and that's a huge thing. It's got an aerodynamic drag coefficient way down at like 25 or 24, which is the lowest of any car in history. That means it moves through the air, and the air is creating the least amount of drag. If you've ever stuck your hand out the window of a car at 60 miles an hour, you can really feel that force. That's what your car is working against to try to keep you going 60 miles an hour. It's actually quite a bit of energy gets expended. There's a formula that the resistance, you know, increases at the square of speed. And so in the end, you know, in order to go from, if your car can do, say, 150 miles an hour, in order to do another 20 miles an hour, you have to have a whole lot more horsepower to make that next 20 miles per hour, because you're already pushing against that super, super strong resistance that occurs from that formula at 150 miles an hour. That's why that 200 mile an hour barrier was so difficult for the high-end sports cars to beat, is because they may have had 550 or 600 horsepower, whatever the number was, and they could get up to 180 or 189 or 185. But now every 5 miles an hour higher takes exponentially more horsepower, because the drag just keeps increasing with the square of speed. So it really, really starts taking some serious horsepower to get over 200 miles an hour. And we do have a number of cars now that do it quite handily. But they require insane amounts of horsepower, like the Bugatti Veyron can do 267 miles an hour. That's a really an amazing accomplishment. It also has 1,230 some odd horsepower to do that. And it's a pretty aerodynamic car. So anyway, so that car can do it. The EPA has rated it, and the EPA uses a really worst case kind of thing. So when the EPA says, as an example, the Volt gets 35 miles or 38, I do 45 all the time in that car, if you drive just lightly. But it's good that they do that. I think it actually gives a real-world example. If you're just driving without thinking about hyper-miling and just, you know, trying to get to your location, it's probably a good number. 265 is a very believable number for the Tesla. So anyway, by the way, one of the things that's going to happen down the road for Tesla, aside from them coming out with their sport utility vehicle, is they're going to try to use the proceeds from these sales for these kind of higher-end cars to finance their low-priced, everybody can afford it, electric car. That's where they're headed. They want to have a low-priced vehicle for the masses, because they see everything going electric and so on. So all of this, what you're seeing them do now, they're basically getting the high-priced cars out there, getting the higher profit margin to use that to get the car for the yous and the me's all out there, for all of us to be able to have an ordinary electric car that would be extraordinary because it's built by this company with their engineering and so on. So that's where they're headed in the end.
They're having an updated day. They're up $1.58.
Yeah. Decent little bounce here. And as we're back at the S&P, not a whole lot to add to anything that we've talked about at all. They're testing this 26 level. I know you have a level close by this as well. Dwayne,
yeah, we got within a point, maybe that's as high as we go. 26. In fact, we got a little bit of a double top there on the hourly.
Yeah.
And it's starting to push down. So maybe we come back and, find some support here at 22, 23 and then inch our way. That's kind of what this thing is. It just sort of keeps inching its way up, you know, mm-hmm. little by
it is.
Little. So,
yeah,
that's
it is.
I don't
It'll
have any more questions in the chat box. If anybody has a question, feel free to type it in.
What if I had a question of the listeners? What do I do if I want to ask a
right
question?
Ahead. You can actually.
I'm
just,
always answering them.
To the soybean question, one point on the soybeans is $50. It's the same as one point in the S&P. One point in the soybeans is equivalent to... One penny in soybeans is one point in the S&P, $50. So that 40-point move today, 40 times 50, it's $2,000.
Yeah.
Per contract.
Yeah. Pretty nice. Very nice move. To be blunt, most people wouldn't have held that long.
No.
They would be, you know, the same stuff that happens always. But that's what we practice for. That's why we get in there and we practice. with the real market and try to see if we can stick with it and trade the trend or whatever your methodology is, trade to targets and so on. Whatever your thing is, you know. But that's it's a beautiful move, and it's a good reminder of how volatile and how almost nonchalant the soybean market puts in a day that's equivalent to 40 S&P points in the S&P, but there's no news about it. It's no big deal, you know. So that's how you know it's probably a market we should be looking at. So,
a couple people commented about Rush Limbaugh. He said that this deal between the New York Times and Tesla, he said neither side could be trusted. So just forget about it.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of interests involved there. I wouldn't think that the New York Times, I would hope the New York Times guy is not trying to, you know, smear them in some way. I mean, that wouldn't be the first time it's happened, but I certainly would hope that's not the case. And I don't think Elon Musk has much to prove. I mean, the car's been vetted out by a number of well-respected car magazines, and it does what they say it'll do. So...
egos always get in the way, and I mean,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Of course, this guy wants to prove his car can do what it's supposed to do, and the other guy wants to, you know, I don't know if this guy had some reason that he wanted, the guy who originally wrote the article, I don't know if he had some motivation or some reason why he wanted to see this thing fail, that part mm-hmm. I don't know.
Listen, maybe the car just didn't do it. Maybe there was some fault in the car. Maybe, who knows, you know. Maybe nobody's doing anything wrong. It just worked out that way, you know. It can happen. So maybe that's just the case. And I would hope, you know, news has gotten so weird because of the left and the right and everyone's fighting their point and stuff. There's very little of real journalism probably left on the planet, at least the Walter Cronkite days. Remember Walter Cronkite? Suddenly that name
Cronkite,
sounds very
yeah.
odd to me, Cronkite.
It's because,
you know,
it's
back
Cronkite.
Then it seemed like a real... What's that?
It's because it's Cronkite.
Cronkite. Oh, thank you.
There you go.
That still sounds like a weird
name. Does that
sound better? It sounds a little weird. It sounds a little better, but it's still weird. But in those days, the journalism, I think, was... I don't know. It just seems like journalism's turned into a blog from even the professionals, and they're all taking their shots and so on. But... I hope that's not the case. What Elon Musk and his company has done is a remarkable accomplishment. It should, you know, I think people should be ashamed of themselves if they were trying to, you know, do something bad to him. Because the guy, all he's trying to do, he's helping the economy. He's got thousands of workers. He's, you know, he's doing what he's supposed to do, which is rise to his own occasion, and he's doing so. But and it doesn't matter what it is, and I'm not saying the New York Times guy is doing this. I actually don't believe he did anything malicious. But there are people that just, for whatever reason, they just don't like to see other people succeed, and they just want to be the, you know, the person that kind of stops the party as best they can. I've talked about that before. Those people, a lot of them are the doomsayers, the gloom and doomers with this, that, and the other. I just would like them to show up. I've said this many times, you know, if you're going to put it out there publicly and make your and throw your dirt, then show up, not just when you've proven right, but show up when you're just plain old dead wrong. Because you never do. You never show up when you're wrong. You never come back and say, boy, I really called that one wrong. You never give the guy credit. You never give the, you know, the Elon or the whoever it is, whatever the situation is. You're not there. You're out doing your next one. You're now finding dirt on somebody else. And at that point, you're just a punk. You know, you're just a little guy just getting your emotional problems solved by doing this. And that's what it all amounts to. If you're going to be blunt, a real man, if you're going to lay it out there, then show up. Not only when you're right, but show up when you're wrong as well. And give the guy credit if you happen to call it wrong. It's rare. It does happen sometimes. Sometimes people do that. But I see an awful lot of people who make their comments, throw the mud, and then they just disappear. And when it all turns out differently, you never hear from them again. But then you see them in another blog or another post somewhere else doing it to someone else. So, what was the... You know, you've seen that before, Duane, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's just human nature. John says that Cronkite means health in German. I'm assuming that's the name that you meant, John? Is that correct?
You talking to me, Dwayne, or? Oh, to John.
Yeah.
So he's saying Konkrete is means good health or health in German.
That is correct. Cronkite.
For those of you who are, you can age yourself, and you won't know this, Dwayne, but others that are in California would know it. Those of you who know the news name Jerry Dunphy, or Dumfrey, I can't remember how it is. Somebody out there knows that name. He used to be a local or a something newscaster, a big guy, when I was just a boy in California. Wonder if anybody remembers that.
I'm not familiar with
Jerry Dunphy, and that's what I think his name was.
Anyway. So far, nobody in the chat room recognizes
okay.
it.
Well, then they're not as old as I am.
All right.
Anyway, so Dwayne, I think that's everything we have for you today. Those are the markets, and we'll continue to watch them. I do expect higher prices in the S&P.
Hey, Bert, are you still there?
So.
Yeah, Dwayne.
There was a question about margins on soybeans. What's intraday and overnight?
Let's see. Let me do a few left clicks here. And click. All right. Soybeans overnight margin is 45.90.
Okay.
So just a little bit over the S&P margin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Day trade margins are half, 22.95.
Okay. So there you go. And, you know, that's the margins, of course, have a lot to do with volatility. Pretty soon there may be no margin for the S&P, maybe like $5 or something. I don't know. It's just not very volatile.
Yeah.
But the soybeans, yeah. So 4,500 overnight and then 22 intraday. Okay.
Correct.
There was a comment on that. All right. But it is a market that has some movement, as we saw, guys. Bring it up one more time real quick. This is the March contract. I mean, this move over the last... just last couple weeks, we had highs up around, well, the swing high here was $14.98. I'm going to call it $15, down to $14. So 100 pennies, which would be 100 points in the S&P over the last 1, 2, 3, 4, really 5 days. So, and that was coming down. Now we've turned around and put in 50 on the way back up. So really, and let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In 7 trading days, there's 150 points of travel there, equivalent to the S&P, 150 points. So, yep, definitely a moving market. Okay, David, I guess that's it. I don't have any more questions in the chat box. Bert, thank you so much for dropping in and hanging out with us.
Thank you for having me on, Dwayne.
All right,
appreciate
David.
It, and look forward to seeing you here tomorrow,
all
for
right.
sure.
We'll see you then.
Okay, bye.
See you.
I didn't notice what time it was. All I know is that I fell in love with you. And if all my dreams come true, I'll be spending time with you. Every day's a new day in love with you. With each day comes a new way of loving you.
Okay, guys, that's going to do it for us on this Tuesday. The Tuesday after President's Day. Quiet market. Let's see if we ever picked up any volume. Nope. Still haven't broke a million. 938,000 contracts. This is the daily chart of the S&P. And you'll notice that we had, coming into the year, we had this little price channel. We gapped up on the first day of the new year, 2013. And we walked underneath that trend line for a number of days. And then we got on top of that trend line And we've just inch by inch slowly walked our way up. Okay. We're at 1525. We're not far from the all-time historic highs in the S&P and in the Dow. So unless anyone has a question about something, that'll end it for today. We covered almost two zones today. We had 1516/17 as support. Ran up to 2223. Went right through that thing. Came back. Spent a little bit of time on top of it. I would expect to see the price come back and do some consolidating here at this 2223. It passed through there a little too easily. Now over here, there was some good consolidation at this level, 24 hours worth. We could look at the euro, but this thing got so confusing. We had an original tweet, consider being short below 133.45. Now, we pointed out, here's where it actually triggered the first time. There was two trades, and then there was a third one that's kind of hidden inside of this big green hourly candle. If you go down to the four tick range chart, you can see it. We looked at it, I think, in the partners meeting the other night. There was an 18 cent move on top of the 32 and the 37. There was also an 18 cent move. And then I tweeted the other night, on Sunday night, that we had had a gap lower open. We gapped right into that zone. And I said, watch what happens, because we might begin to see this number that we had used to go short on the euro. That level, 133.45, might very well become support. And then after we gapped lower on that open, we printed dynamic support, okay, which we had not seen dynamic support for a few days on the euro. In fact, we have to go all the way back to, was it the 13th, I believe? The 12th, I guess. No, 13th. Yeah, up here. So there was two things there. One, we were, from a higher perspective, we were gapping down into this number, 133.45, and then we printed dynamic support. So I commented about that on the Twitter feed, and then we ran up like 50 pips on the euro. Then we came back to test this 133.45. Now it's working in the other direction, okay? 24, 23, 14, and then it just kind of gets crazy. We run way up here to 134. Now this is an hourly chart, and we're printing dynamic resistance at 134. Now, since we got that dynamic support, we had support print twice. Now there was a question, let's see, from Kyle. Where's dynamic support and resistance on the S&P? On the S&P, oh, looks like we're not done. Look at that. We're going to get that 27 yet. Okay. Insert. Indicators. CFSR. Okay. If we roll back to Friday, we had dynamic support here. We had dynamic resistance here. And then on the Sunday night Globex open, you can see we printed dynamic support here. And then as we went through that very quiet President's Day, resistance, support, resistance. Now look what happened. We broke through the resistance. Remember what I said about the dynamic support and resistance? It sets you up for a good trade, whether the support or resistance holds or breaks. You can trade it either way. If you traded it as resistance here, you know, you got a couple points out of it, looks like. Potentially, you could have. Such a quiet day, though. But then we come up and we break after it holds for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. After it holds for 6 hours, we close above it, and then we pull back, and now it acts as support. See how it's resistance here for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. We break above it. We pull back. It holds for 1, 2 hours as support. And that sets the stage for this move that we're seeing now up to this weekly zone at 2728. The next thing we'll expect it to print will be dynamic support. Because once it's printed resistance, the red dots, the way the formula works is it's got to print support. Because you would, you know, your eye right now is looking for some red dots up here. Where's the top? Well, it can't find resistance until it finds support, because that's how the formula unfolds. Support, resistance, support, resistance, support, resistance. Okay, so we've got broken resistance here. And if we hit this zone, 2728, and we get a pullback, I'm just going to just take a guess. If we hit the zone, 2728, and then we get a pullback into this 2425 area, that may be where we see dynamic support print. Now, this is on an hourly. Remember, you can apply this indicator on any time frame, and depending upon what time frame you're in, you're going to see support and resistance showing up in different places. And that's why I recommend that you do use multiple time frames, that you learn to watch multiple time frames, which will lead you to learning to think in multiple time frames. Oh, Richard, I'm sorry. I missed your question for David. I apologize. Does David see the 25th as plus or minus as an important? I am really sorry, Richard. I missed that. If you will type it in tomorrow, I'll be sure to ask him. I certainly did miss that, or I would have been happy to ask him. Richard's question, guys, was about February the 25th. He wanted to know if David had that as an important day, as some type of a turning point or something. So just remind me tomorrow, Richard, and I'll ask him. Or you can give him a call, because, you know, he'll be happy to go over it with you. The other question, I guess that's it for the questions. Okay, so in answer to your question, Kyle, that's where we are. We're waiting on support on the hourly, but on the daily chart, let's go over here to the daily chart and see what we got. Okay, on the daily chart, this is interesting. We broke resistance way back on November. Well, we hit dynamic resistance on November the 28th. We closed above it November 30th. We held on this pullback right here at the beginning of the new year. Almost 2 months. And remember, we'll have to find support before we can find resistance again. Now that's from a daily perspective, okay? Now we can also okay, that's daily on the S&P. We already know what that looks like. Let's go see what it looks like on a 5 minute. Okay, so on a 5 minute chart, we broke resistance here, support held, and then we had dynamic resistance come into play at 15.25.75. The market traded back down to all the way to 1524. And now it's back up at dynamic resistance again, 1526. But we're breaking through that. But on this one, a little bit different scenario because we have this weekly zone right overhead at 2728. And I think we just hit it right there at 27. Yep. There we go. Now, I don't, we're certainly not expecting any news today. Tomorrow we have the Fed notes release, I believe. So that could hold some sway over the markets. But we've done this, 2728. We got to the zone. We know that we've broken resistance here, dynamic resistance on the hourly. So now we're looking for dynamic support on the hourly. It could pull back into this 2223. I'll be surprised if we can, if we move farther than 28 today, the top of the zone. We do have 2 hours left to trade, so it's certainly a possibility. But I would be surprised. I think this will pretty much be it for today. And then on a pullback, we'll find our dynamic support. Okay. Little green dots. All right. That's it, guys. Thanks so much for tuning in. Whoever you are, wherever you are, may God continue to richly bless you with His mercy and with His grace. And I'll see you at the bell.
Remember this. There is no greater return on investment than to see a human life changed and given hope. As always, pray hard and trade safe. Any financial information discussed on this show is simply the opinion of our host, Dwayne Reeves, his co-hosts, and guests. To learn more about trading e-mini futures or to take a one-week free trial in our live trading room, call 1-866-928-3310. 866-928-3310. Information discussed on this radio program should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Always do your own due diligence and consult with a licensed securities broker or financial planner before making any investment decisions.